May be seated. Thank you. We're going to proceed with our second oral argument of the day. It's Catherine Davis versus Richard Otten and Mimic Insurance Company. We have Earl Green III appearing for Mimic Insurance, appellant in this case. He will be arguing, and Dean Faust is present and will be arguing on behalf of the Appellees, or Appellee Catherine Davis. Each of you will have 20 minutes for initial argument, and then Mr. Green, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. There is a warning light up here. It'll turn yellow at 2 minutes and give you an indication that your time is almost up. With that, Mr. Green, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Faust. I have to start by saying I'm going into my 39th year of practice, and I just got my South Dakota license 6 months ago. So 6 months later, to be standing before this court is a privilege and an honor, and I'm glad to be here today. I thank you in advance for your time and your attention to this case, and probably your patience in listening to my argument today. As the court knows, this case is before the court on an intermediate appeal from the Fourth Judicial Circuit Court, and a decision by Judge Comer in that case overruling a motion to dismiss I filed in that case on behalf of my client, Mimic Insurance. The basis of the motion to dismiss was my belief that the Fourth Judicial Circuit does not have personal jurisdiction over my client, Mimic Insurance, which is based in Michigan. The lawsuit involves a claim for personal injury sustained by Ms. Davis, and she sued Mr. Otten, who is a tortfeasor in the case, along with Mimic, who carried her automobile liability insurance, which included the underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage. Mimic is a Michigan-based insurance company. Its headquarters is in Auburn Hills, Michigan. It issued the policy of insurance in February of 2019 to Ms. Davis in Michigan. Ms. Davis is a resident of Michigan. The only contact with the state of South Dakota is the fact that a motorcycle accident happened near Sturgis on July 28, 2019, in which Ms. Davis sustained her injuries as a passenger on a motorcycle. So it's our contention that the court does not have jurisdiction over a Michigan-based insurance company who issued a policy in Michigan to a Michigan resident, despite the fact the accident did happen in South Dakota. At the motion to dismiss, an evidentiary hearing was held. And I would note for this court that the only evidence produced at that hearing was by myself on behalf of Mimic. There were three exhibits offered, and those are all part of the transcript of that proceeding. The court, as I mentioned, overruled the motion to dismiss, but did not make any findings in that order. She just simply said, motion denied, and that's basically what the order actually entered in the case says, motion denied. So I can't tell you, I can't argue why the court was wrong, because I really don't know what the basis of the court's decision was coming from that trial court decision. So I've got to kind of cover the whole spectrum of possibilities here today, and I will try to do so. As I see it, there are really four issues before this court. The first is an argument the appellee, Ms. Davis, raised as part of the motion to dismiss. And again, on appeal, and that's her belief that this case was actually settled at some point prior to this appeal being taken. I strongly disagree with that. I've set out all the reasons why I disagree in my reply brief in this case, and I'm not going to go into detail right at this time because I don't think that's the important argument. I think it's clear cut.
You mentioned, go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. I do want to ask you about that
because
you do address it in your reply brief and your argument. I understand the argument, which is, hey, they filed a lawsuit after we made the offer, didn't respond to it, so they've essentially rejected it. I get that.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any authority, though, for that? Or is that just sort of a general premise? I mean, in other words, they accepted it before you withdrew it. Does that make any difference? Is there authority out there that says you file a lawsuit and you reject the offer?
The authority, I think, is what I set forth in my brief, where my client is allowed objectively to look at the actions of Ms. Davis in this case. And objectively, it appeared by all actions or inactions of Ms. Davis that the settlement offer had been rejected. She didn't respond, or I'm sorry, her attorney didn't respond to two or three phone calls making the offer. There was no response whatsoever to the offer. And 5 months later, a lawsuit is filed. So objectively to my client, which this court has said, my client is allowed to view this matter objectively. On that basis, it appears the settlement offer was rejected.
Well, we also have some case law in terms of whether an agreement has been made can be a fact question. If you don't have, you know, if you don't have a clear release signed and things like that, you may have a fact question as to whether a settlement's been completed. Does that apply here?
Possibly. But I think, again, the main consideration is the fact my client can objectively look at the facts and say her response was to file a lawsuit and to, again, ask for the limits of the underinsured. I mean, that might have been a counteroffer or a counter demand at that point.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Justice.
No, I'm done.
That's where I want to go with just that sub-issue. I don't want to take all your time on it, but of course, there's no ruling from the circuit court judge on this. So right. Even if we were postured as a reviewing court for that issue, and I don't know with this intermediate appeal whether we are or we aren't, but even if we were, there's no order to review. So this mootness argument would only arise as an original claim for relief in front of us. Is there any facts or any evidence or anything that details what the settlement negotiations were, the sequence of events, what led to the next, to the next, to the next thing? Because as you say, it seemed to me the only evidence in the record was the offering that you had made with some declarations and some evidence, or excuse me, some affidavits at the hearing.
That's the extent of it, Justice. The Exhibit 3, which was the declaration of Charles Billing, the senior adjuster from MIMIC, who handled the negotiations, set out the timeline in that exhibit saying...
So there's not a factual record. I'm sorry, forgive me for interrupting. But no. There's not a factual record that says this was the order of events for the settlement, this is how it went down. And of course, we're not a fact-finding body.
Only to the extent it's contained in Exhibit 3 before the court. That set out the timeline of events and why Mr. Billings believed the offer had been rejected.
Understood. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Chief Justice?
No, okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's a little more of an issue there than I thought. But that is the first issue on the appeal. The second issue is whether or not MIMIC has the minimum contacts with the state of South Dakota needed for a court to exercise long-arm jurisdiction over MIMIC pursuant to SDCL 15-7-2, the long-arm statute. The third issue before the court is the trial court's attempt to exercise personal jurisdiction and whether or not that attempt met the due process procedural requirements required by the United States Constitution under the 14th Amendment. Then the fourth issue is tying it all up. If, in fact, the trial court did not have jurisdiction over the case, should the lawsuit have been dismissed because the appellee's complaint fails to state a cause of action upon which relief may be granted? Now, this court has set forth in a previous decision in 2014, the Custom Cycle versus Boyer case, I think a really good analysis of the same kind of fact situation we have here. And it sets forth that three-part test that a trial court and this court must utilize in order to determine whether or not personal jurisdiction exists in a case. And that, without going into detail on that three-part test, it is set out in the briefs and in the custom cycle case. But inherent within that three-part test is looking at the long-arm statute and the 14 conditions that can be met in order to allow a trial court to exercise jurisdiction over a defendant in a case. And there are four of those 14 requirements that plaintiff appellee is focused on. And so I think it's important we take a look at those four. The first one under SDCL 15.7.2 subsection 1 states that a person is subject to jurisdiction of a South Dakota court if it transacts any business within the state. Now, again, my client is a Michigan corporation that issued a policy of insurance in Michigan to a Michigan citizen, a Michigan resident. It had absolutely no business transactions within the state of South Dakota at any time. That's all apparent through Exhibit 1 that we offered in the case, which was the declaration of Frank White, the general counsel for MEMIC, outlining the fact that that MEMIC has no contact with the state of, the state of South Dakota whatsoever. Now, the appellee attempts to argue in her brief that certain policy language that she believes this court can utilize to find, or the trial court could have utilized to find, that business was transacted. But I would again point out to this court, the insurance policy issued by my client is not in evidence in this case. This court cannot speculate about what that insurance policy might consist of. I know the appellee attached it and filed it with the clerk of this court, but it was not offered to the trial court. It was not received into evidence by the court. You look at the certificate of transcript from the trial court, there's no mention of any exhibit involving the MEMIC insurance policy. So for appellee to now argue that some language in that policy constitutes evidence of MEMIC transacting business within the state of South Dakota, I think is entirely misplaced. And the appellee should not be asking this court to engage in speculation about what that policy says, because the policy is not in evidence. The appellee also points to the state of South Dakota and America Bankers case as support for the position that an insurance company can transact business in a state, even though the insurance company is an out-of-state corporation. I think the American Bankers case is entirely distinguishable, because in that case, America Bankers purchased a couple of smaller insurance companies, but actively charged and collected premiums in the state of South Dakota from South Dakota residents. So it had that contact, those minimum contacts. It did transact business. And this court found that both long arm statute sections 1 and 2 applied in order to confer jurisdiction in that case. Those type of contacts are entirely missing in the case before the court now. Appley also argues that subparagraph 2 of the long arm statute applies. That part of the long armor statute states that if the defendant commits a tort or causes an action or commits an action which causes a tort to accrue within the state, then a court may exercise jurisdiction over that defendant. Simply put, MEMIC did not commit a tort in the state of South Dakota, and it took no action which resulted in the accrual of a tort. All it did was write an insurance policy in the state of Michigan to a Michigan resident who later got in a motorcycle accident near Sturgis. MEMIC did nothing to cause the accident, didn't cause the accident to come about. There's no tort connection whatsoever. Section 2 of the long-arm statute doesn't apply. Now, the plaintiff relies in her brief on the Rothlubers versus OB case as supportive of her position. And again, that Rothlubers case is entirely distinguishable, because that case involved a German touring company transporting German tourists around several Midwestern states on an agricultural tour. And in that case, the German touring company used one of its own employees to rent vans in Chicago, drive them to South Dakota. There were actually two scheduled stops in South Dakota, one in Pierre, one in Spearfish. And the group may have even spent a night in South Dakota. So again, there was direct physical contact, not physical, but there is the direct contact in that case that the German touring company had by renting the vans, driving the vans in the state of South Dakota, staying in South Dakota, visiting places in South Dakota, and its own employee who drove the van that got in an accident out on I-90 near Ellsworth Air Force Base. He committed the tort. He lost control of the van in that case, crashed, injured a bunch of people, and killed one person. So in that case, yes, there was a direct tort committed by an out-of-state defendant that allowed the court to exercise long-arm jurisdiction in the case. The appellee also relies on Section 15-7-2, subparagraph 4 of the long-arm statute. This section states that a jurisdiction can be exerted if the defendant contracts to insure any person located within the state at the time of contracting. If you look at Exhibit 2, which is the coverage letter that, denial of coverage letter that Mamick sent to Ms. Davis, it sets out on there the fact that this policy period was February 18th, I believe it was, of 2019 to February 18th of 2020. So we have a policy issued on February 18th in the state of Michigan to a Michigan resident. The fact that it was issued in Michigan is set forth in Mr. White's declaration. Again, that's Exhibit 1. As such, we have a policy of insurance issued to an insured in the state of Michigan. So this section of the long-arm statute, which requires that the defendant contracts to insure any person located within the state at the time of contracting. The time of contracting was February of 2019. It took place in Michigan, not in Colorado. That section of the long arm statute does not apply.
Does the additional term in that provision that refers to the risk have any application here? And if so, why not?
I don't believe so, because again, it was at the, I want to look at the exact wording of that so we're on the same page. I think that the operative phrase there is, sure, you can say contracting to insure any risk located within the state at the time of contracting. I think if you jump to the risk located within the state, you're going to have to assume or speculate as to what the coverage territory of the policy may be. There's no evidence in front of this court, nor in front of the trial court, as to the coverage territory.
That did seem to be one of the primary arguments your opponent's counsel was making. And so, as I understand your response, is that would require looking at the insurance policy, and that's not in evidence?
Absolutely, Justice. It's not in evidence, and so you don't know what the coverage territory in fact is, and you would be speculating as to whether or not it covers one state, it covers all 50 states, if it covers foreign jurisdictions. The appellee, the plaintiff, carries the burden of proof in a case like this to establish personal jurisdiction. Because there was a evidentiary hearing with the trial court, and as case law, I believe it's a custom cycle case, states, the plaintiff actually has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that personal jurisdiction exists in a case like this. And the plaintiff did not produce any evidence at that hearing, the evidentiary hearing, to establish any details of that insurance policy or the risks covered that would enable the trial court or this court to say this section of the long-arm statute might apply.
The other, it makes me wonder when I look at 15-7-2, really how much of a hurdle the long arm statute is. And plaintiff doesn't specifically address sub 14, but it's kind of a catch all. The commission of any act, as long as it's not inconsistent with the Constitution or due process. So you got to identify some act that would hail you into court here in South Dakota and provide minimum contacts. I don't know if the plaintiffs necessarily identified that, but it seems like 14 sort of says, as long as it's consistent with due process, if there's some act that brings you within the jurisdiction of the state, you really just are doing a due process analysis. Do you disagree with that?
Are you
I'm referring to subparagraph 14 of 15-7-2, and I know it wasn't specifically addressed in the brief, but so maybe it's an unfair question. But.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice. Let me get to my. Well, I would agree that it is a catch-all, but ultimately it would come back to the question, I think, as you just mentioned, whether a due process being met in trying to apply that section of the long-arm statute. And for the reasons I will try to get into here, I see I only have 2 minutes left. So it's my belief that the three-part test set out in the custom cycle case, this court is still going to do that analysis. And if it does that analysis, when it does that analysis, due process is not being met in this case because not all three of those conditions set out in the custom cycle test are going to be met in order for due process requirement to be established in this case. So I agree it's kind of a catch-all, but ultimately due process has to be met, and I don't think it is in this case. In regards to that three-part test, the first part of the test states that the appellant would have to avail itself of the privilege of acting in South Dakota. And
yeah, it looks like your red light's on.
Yeah, it did pop on. Well, may take this up in rebuttal. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Faust, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. First, I would like to set forth a brief statement of the facts that have us here today. On July 28, 2019, Catherine Davis was a passenger on a motorcycle that was struck by Richard Otten. Davis sustained serious injuries and damages. Medical bills alone incurred were in excess of $300,000. The majority of that medical care and medical bills occurred here in South Dakota. Otten, the other motorcyclist, had a $25,000 liability insurance policy that had been offered but has not been accepted by Davis. The MIMIC insurance policy that insures Davis has underinsured motorist coverage, personal injury protection benefits, and other coverages that plaintiff asserts are triggered by both this collision and separately by the offer of liability policy limits by Otten's carrier, which thus trigger in South Dakota the underinsured motorist coverage under the MIMIC policy. Davis brought suit for personal injury against Otten, as well as against MIMIC for breach of insurance contract, including for underinsured motorist benefits, as the liability policy limits of $25,000 have been offered by defendant Otten, thus making in South Dakota defendant Otten an underinsured motorist. Subsequent to filing suit, MIMIC made a motion to dismiss under SDCL 15.6.12b subsection 2, challenging the court's personal jurisdiction over MIMIC. The court denied MIMIC's motion to dismiss, finding jurisdiction over MIMIC. First issue I would like to briefly address that has been somewhat addressed in the briefing before the court is whether or not the underlying case against MIMIC, the underinsured motorist carrier, has been settled. I would assert that it has been settled. In the affidavit I submitted to the trial court, which would be Plaintiff's Exhibit 5. In paragraph 8, I explained and attached an exhibit labeled as 5 being MIMIC's emailed offer of $75,000 that they asserted was policy limits available on the underinsured motorist claim. In that same affidavit, paragraph 9, I explained and attached Exhibit 6, being my correspondence directed to MEMIC, which accepted the offer of $75,000. Also in that affidavit was separately the declarations page showing the coverages afforded by MEMIC that was presented to the trial court. Thus, I would argue that there was an offer by MEMIC that they asserted to be the policy limits. That offer was accepted by myself with no evidence presented that the offer was in any way withdrawn.
Did you bring suit before you accepted, in your view, this through this letter, the offer?
No, suit was filed first. Subsequent to suit, the offer was taken. Second issue, being what I would say is the main issue before the court today, is whether MEMIC had minimum contacts with South Dakota to allow the trial court to exercise personal jurisdiction over MEMIC. First, as the court knows, we look at the South Dakota long-arm statute, being SDCL 1572, which sets forth minimum contacts for personal jurisdiction over MEMIC. This court previously stated in Denver Truck and Trailer Sales versus Design and Building Services that the South Dakota long-arm statute is to be construed broadly when evaluating jurisdiction. SDCL 1572, the long-arm statute, provides 14 separate acts that provide for jurisdiction. I assert that the following acts under this statute are met for jurisdiction. Act number one being the transaction of any business within the state. There are two primary actions to insurance coverage, one being the actual selling of insurance coverage, and two, the handling, adjusting, and paying claims under these policies. MEMIC's arguments and briefing only focus on the selling of policies, not the handling, adjusting, and paying claims under those policies, which is what provides the contacts for jurisdiction here. While MEMIC may not sell policies in the state of South Dakota, they nonetheless still provide every policyholder of theirs insurance coverage while in the borders of South Dakota per their policy, and then MEMIC adjusts those claims occurring in South Dakota, thus providing insurance coverage to motorists while in South Dakota. MEMIC also knows that by virtue of selling numerous policies, that those policyholders will leave their home state, in this case, Michigan, and will at times be involved in collisions, such as this very same collision that occurred here in South Dakota.
So let's say that contacts, and I'm not saying this is the case, but let's say that you're right about that argument. What about the next step when it comes to purposeful availment, Mr. Faust? Is there some evidence, something that we could see that indicates that MEMIC directed its contacts at the forum state, sought the protection of the laws of South Dakota, and in some way purposefully availed itself of the protections of South Dakota court such that it could reasonably anticipate being hailed into a South Dakota court?
I think that MEMIC does so with all 50 states. MEMIC purposely sells insurance that per the terms of the policy and per the laws of each of those states, including the law of South Dakota, meets the coverage requirements in South Dakota per the policy for those operators operating in South Dakota.
And I understand your argument. How is that directing their contact with the state to the forum? In some ways, what I'm asking is, you know, that the context can't be, as we say, isolated and fortuitous or random. They've got to be directed at the forum. How the fact that an insurer of MEMIC might wind up in California or South Dakota or Wyoming on some level might seem a little random. So how is it that they're directing their contacts at this state?
Well, I would suggest it's not random. We have an interstate that crosses South Dakota and people from various states cross South Dakota every day. MEMIC
But I'm talking about their contacts with the state. I'm not talking about where people go. I'm talking about their contacts with the state.
Well, I would argue that the contacts that you're asking about would be the actual conducting of the claims process and the claims and paying claims and handling claims in South Dakota. That is, in my opinion, doing business in the state of South Dakota.
Was there evidence of adjusting activity in South Dakota and paying of claims in South Dakota that you presented to the court?
Well, I would suggest in this case, there's the contact in my affidavit submitted that MEMIC had made the offer of policy limits of $75,000 to myself, which is coming into the state of South Dakota, I would argue.
That's interesting that you say it, because that's subsection 11 of the long arm statute, you know, participating in litigation or settlement or arbitration or mediation. But as I read your brief, I didn't see that argument being made. I thought that the settlement argument was more directed at, hey, is this a justiciable claim or not? Is there anything here? Is this a ripe controversy? I didn't see you making the argument that subsection 11 of the long arm statute is implicated by the efforts to settle. Maybe I missed it, though.
Well, I would say maybe I could have made a better argument.
Oh, you could be in there. Is it in there? Because I didn't think I saw it.
Well, I'll let you be the judge if it's there. I would say I could have made a better argument, but to the court, I would represent that affidavit to the trial court that the argument was made and that them participating in settlement negotiations is conducting business under that section in South Dakota.
Turning back to the settlement offer that you addressed at your issue one, was the validity of the settlement offer ever brought before the circuit court for a ruling, or did the court address that at all?
I would say no, the court did not address that. The court did not get past, in my opinion, the jurisdiction argument.
So to a certain extent, then, you're making that argument for the first time on appeal, the validity of the settlement?
To a certain extent, yes.
Let me see if I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, well, the bigger issue there for you is you want us to declare this lawsuit moot based on that settlement offer and negotiations that took place. Wouldn't we first have to decide whether we have jurisdiction? If we have jurisdiction, then we remand it to the court. To figure that out.
Yes.
I mean, we can't really get to mootness at this point and figure out if there's a settlement.
I don't believe so with the jurisdiction issue before the court.
On that settlement, help me understand the time frame. I may not have it exactly right. I do see now, and I had overlooked it. My apologies when I was visiting earlier with Mr. Green. There was that hiccup in the transcript, you know, where Exhibit 4 came in before 3, and I think I got mixed up and didn't see 3, and I'm seeing your affidavit as well that does provide some factual basis for the sequence of events relating to the settlement. But is the time frame that your letter accepting it is May of 21? Am I right on that?
Yes.
We granted the petition for intermediate appeal in August of 21, right? Does that sound right?
It sounds right. I believe so.
Was there an effort along the way? And it's not forever, but there's several months in intervening there. Was there ever an effort to enforce what you believe the settlement agreement to be in front of the circuit court, as if to sort of say, hey, look, this is a done deal, not just in terms of mootness, but we want our money?
No. And I would say the reason for that is MEMIC has not officially answered the lawsuit against them in the underlying trial court. This matter was taken up on appeal over jurisdiction that was before the trial court. And so my belief to a large degree would be that I would need jurisdiction before the trial court before trying to enforce that agreement that I believe is an agreement to settle the case. This court in State versus American Bankers Insurance Company looked at a Texas insurance company that was not licensed itself to do business in South Dakota and found jurisdiction under SDCL 7-2 subpart 1, noting that under South Dakota law, chapter 58, defined insurance business broadly, including all matters arising out of that contract or any claim they're under, and that payment of claims arose out of the insurance contract. Thus, I would argue that similarly, MEMIC, in handling claims from South Dakota, has the contact of transacting business within South Dakota with jurisdiction established under Act 1. Under Act 2 of the long-arm statute, the commission of any act which results in accrual within this state of a tort action, I would argue that the collision resulted in a tort action here in South Dakota, being necessary to set the value of damages on the injuries suffered by Davis for the amounts due under the MEMIC underinsured motorist claim. That as the underinsured motorist claim derives out of and is part of the underlying tort claim, I argue that this subpart is also met. Act number 4, contracting to insure any person, property, or risk located within the state at the time of contracting. As the MEMIC policy covers all states, including South Dakota, MEMIC contracted to insure both Davis and the risk of her being involved in a collision while in South Dakota.
Counsel, what is your response to MEMIC's counsel that it would be inappropriate for this court to rely upon terms of the insurance policy when it has not been admitted as before the court below?
I would argue that the declarations page showing that there is insurance coverage through MEMIC and the amounts of coverage was submitted by affidavit to the trial court. And secondly, that pursuant to South Dakota law, any insurance in South Dakota has to comply with the requirements of South Dakota. And so I believe that there's enough there for the court to decide, even if the court decides that they can't look at the actual MEMIC insurance policy, because there simply, there is insurance and it's through MEMIC and that's not disputed. Under Act number 11, commencing or participating in negotiations, mediation, arbitration, or litigation involving subject matter located in whole or in part within the state. Again, and this was discussed a bit earlier, I would assert that the collision resulted in a tort action here in South Dakota, which is necessary to set the value of damages suffered by Davis under the underinsured motorist claim. Again, MEMIC has admitted to having participated in negotiations involving claims made under the MEMIC policy, also here in South Dakota, including having offered the $75,000 underinsured limits, thus having participated in negotiations involving the subject matter of this injury claim and the MEMIC contract claim, meeting the conditions under Part 11 for jurisdiction. I would also assert that these contacts that I have discussed would carry over to subpart 14 and be enough for the court to find, jurisdiction. These acts clearly show minimum contacts with South Dakota under the long-arm statute. Likewise, the due process requirements are also met. The court set the three-part due process test as stated in Marschke as follows. Part one, the defendant must purposely avail himself to the privilege of acting in the forum state, thus invoking the benefits and protections of its laws. While MEMIC may not be licensed in South Dakota, nor have offices nor sell policies, on the sales side versus the claim side, MEMIC purposely sold policies, again, good in all 50 states, including South Dakota, thus acting in South Dakota by providing insurance coverage, knowing that their policyholders would be in South Dakota, having incidents in South Dakota, that would give rise to claims and adjusting and paying those claims here in South Dakota. This would avail MEMIC to acting in South Dakota and invoking the benefits and protections of South Dakota laws. Subpart two, the cause of action must arise from the defendant's activities directed at the forum state. Again, MEMIC provides policies available in South Dakota. I'm sorry. The policies for purchase are not available, but those policies for out-of-state motorists carry over into South Dakota and ensure the risks that occur here in South Dakota. Part three, the acts of the defendant must have substantial connection with the forum state to make the exercise of jurisdiction over the defendant a reasonable one. These same factors apply under part three. Remember, MEMIC is not a single individual, but a large insurance company, thus being foreseeable to MEMIC that claims under MEMIC's policies will be triggered by collisions in South Dakota. MEMIC sells a product of insurance, knowing it will provide coverage in South Dakota, subject to claims arising in South Dakota under South Dakota law. The Klins versus ABI International, I would assert, is very similar to this case. It involves specific jurisdiction over an insurance company where this court held that a foreign insurance provider, which provided insurance to a foreign exchange student who was killed in an occurrence in South Dakota, had a substantial connection with South Dakota, as it should have anticipated that it could be brought into court wherever the insured foreign exchange student resided or traveled, this court ruled. I would argue that that case is very similar to this one and provides a basis for jurisdiction here over MEMIC. Regarding issue three, that the trial court lacked, if the trial court lacked personal jurisdiction, if dismissal would be proper under 15.6.12b5, I would assert to the court no, that the applicable statute would be 15.6.12b2 for lack of jurisdiction over the person as being the basis for dismissal, that the court looked at jurisdiction and did not look at part five. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Faust. You may proceed with your 10-minute rebuttal, Mr. Green.
Okay, I have to kind of hit and miss a couple points here. Nothing real logical in this rebuttal. First, I again have to highlight to the court that based on the certificate of transcript filed with this court, there were only three exhibits filed with this court. Exhibit one, which was the declaration of Frank White, general counsel for MEMIC. Exhibit two, the letter from MEMIC to Ms. Davis denying coverage because of exclusionary language. And exhibit three, the declaration of Charles Billings, the adjuster handling the claim. There is no exhibit four. There is no exhibit five, the affidavit of Mr. Faust. And there's no exhibit six, the insurance policy. Those simply were not offered at the trial court level, and this court cannot consider evidence not properly submitted at the trial court level as part of this appeal process. Mr. Faust just mentioned the Avi International case as a basis for finding jurisdiction, and I would suggest to this court that that case is also distinguishable. Yes, Avi was an out-of-state insurance broker that provided insurance for a foreign exchange student from Germany, I believe, who was subsequently killed in a car accident while attending high school here in South Dakota. But in that case, Avi International knew full well what it was insuring. It knew there was a foreign exchange student that was going to be living in South Dakota. It knew that foreign exchange student was going to be going to school here in South Dakota. Those minimum contacts that Avi knew about, specifically connected to South Dakota, is entirely different from the situation with MEMIC, which has no knowledge of Ms. Davis's activities. It didn't know beforehand when it wrote the policy that Ms. Davis would be in South Dakota or any other state. So the specific knowledge that Avi International had in that case, I believe, distinguishes it from the set of facts before the court on this case.
Counsel, can you respond to the argument just made that MEMIC's handling and adjusting and attempts to settle that occurred would be sufficient under either the long arm statute or the due process requirements to provide jurisdiction here.
I guess my only thought on that was that the initial determination on the policy was directed to Ms. Davis, who is a resident of Michigan. That letter was sent to her in Michigan. As far as, two phone calls, three phone calls made to Mr. Faust's office, the exchange of one email from Mr. Faust purportedly accepting, or I'm sorry, from me making an offer and then one email rejecting it. I would go back to the Custom Cycle case in which there were a series of three or four phone calls between the North Carolina resident who bought the motorcycle in Minnesota and asked that it be shipped to South Dakota, where the customization of the bike took place. There were a couple phone calls between those two, the buyer and the company here in South Dakota that did the customization. There may have even been an email involved in there. But this court found those were not the type of sufficient contacts necessary in order for a court to exercise specific personal jurisdiction over the defendant. I think those are very tangential contacts that in the Custom Cycle case, this court did not find were sufficient enough to establish jurisdiction. That would be my thought on that, Justice.
Well, the other distinction here, and I don't know if there's any case law, but you're dealing with counsel for a Michigan resident who happens to live, who is an attorney in South Dakota. And I understand why they hired a South Dakota attorney, because they had a PI case here, but then they've got this contract dispute with you and it's a Michigan resident. So the parties are Michigan residents.
Yes.
Does that make a difference? I mean, is there any cases you're aware of or authority that, can the fact that you're negotiating with an attorney in South Dakota who represents a Michigan resident, does that make a difference? And does that create some sort of minimum contacts or not?
Well, I would argue it would be a lot more persuasive if it was a South Dakota resident being represented by a South Dakota attorney and we were doing that negotiations. The fact it's a Michigan resident arguing for coverage under a Michigan policy, the fact she has a South Dakota attorney, to me, I think it's a very minimal type of contact, and it's not the kind that where we are, MEMIC is trying to avail itself of South Dakota law.
Well, in fact, a Michigan resident chose to hire a South Dakota attorney to sue a Michigan company.
True. I just don't.
That's not something you had control over.
Nothing we had control over. We did not direct any activity towards South Dakota or ask Ms. Davis, please go hire a South Dakota attorney because you think your only cause of action is in South Dakota. I would disagree with that. I think there could have been a Michigan action brought here since the denial of coverage occurred before the lawsuit got filed. If I was a plaintiff's counsel, I'd want to find out if I had coverage or not before I file a personal injury lawsuit seeking benefits under the policy.
So in your brief, you suggested a filing perhaps in federal court?
Federal court probably wouldn't cut it because we wouldn't have the diversity needed.
So then the trial courts expressed some concern about the fact that the plaintiff will have to bring litigation in two states if there's no jurisdiction in South Dakota, namely a deck action of some sort in Michigan and then further proceedings if there is coverage here in South Dakota.
Yes, and I know she said that didn't sit well with her, but that wouldn't happen in every case. I think it's really important in this case to know that the denial of coverage letter went out in July of 20. The lawsuit was filed in February of 21. So the plaintiff in this case knew ahead of time MEMIC is denying coverage on this case. So again, if I'm plaintiff's counsel, before I'm going to invest time and expenses in a personal injury lawsuit in South Dakota, I'm thinking I better find out if there's insurance coverage for this underinsured motorist claim arising out of a Michigan insurance policy. Yes, I think there should have been or could have been a lawsuit filed in Michigan on a deck action. Do we have coverage or not? If you win that lawsuit, great. You file a second lawsuit in South Dakota, all you're dealing with is damages. That's all that's left at that point. If you lose that lawsuit in Michigan, you don't even file a second lawsuit because you know my damages are already basically capped at the underlying limits of $25,000. Why am I going to file a lawsuit against somebody that I believe is going to be judgment proof and I already have an offer for the policy limits?
But in any event, if I could interrupt, but in any event,
certainly.
The idea that there would be potentially two lawsuits and maybe in different forms seems to implicate more venue concepts or inconvenient forum concepts and may seem to stray a bit from the discrete issue that we've got here, which is one solely related to personal jurisdiction.
I would agree, Justice. Now, what we are focused on jurisdiction here, the contacts that MIMIC did or didn't have with South Dakota, and I just don't believe they're present in this instance. So ultimately, we respectfully request this court to reverse the trial court decision denying the motion to dismiss and remand this case to the trial court with a directive to sustain the motion to dismiss and dismiss the plaintiff's complaint, both for want of jurisdiction and for failing to state a cause of action upon which relief may be granted. If there are no other further questions, we'll wrap it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will conclude the arguments in this case. I want to thank counsel for your briefing and arguments on behalf of the court, and we'll be in recess for 10 minutes.